Wart Local News.
The more I'm with you, pretty baby, the more I feel my love increase. I'm building all my dreams around you. My happiness will never cease.
The time is now 6 o'clock on the dot, and welcome to WORT's local news for Thursday, April 24th, 2025. I'm your host, Christina Leffring.
And I'm your host, Carlos Dávalos. In tonight's news, a daytime resource center for unhoused people shuttered their downtown location yesterday.
The reported number of unhoused students hit a high mark last year in Wisconsin's public schools.
The local United Nations Association is hosting their second annual Women's Summit.
And in the second half, a state office answers the public's questions about open records law, opening day of the regular fishing season is around the corner, and Madison's flamingos get a new uniform.
All these and more on tonight's news, but first we go live to the BBC for some news from around the world.
BBC News with Sue Montgomery. President Trump has insisted he's putting a lot of pressure on Russia and Ukraine to reach a peace deal. Speaking in the Oval Office, he declined to say what specific pressure he was exerting on the Kremlin. Earlier, he expressed rare criticism of the Russian president, condemning Wednesday night's deadly missile strikes in Kyiv. Gary O'Donoghue is in Washington.
This is a small departure, if you like, because he shies away from criticising Vladimir Putin quite often, and his words were quite strong on that. Nevertheless, when he was asked directly what pressure he was putting on Vladimir Putin in terms of coming to the table to do a deal, he wouldn't specify, he wouldn't say. He simply said, look, he wouldn't be talking if we weren't putting lots of pressure, and of course he's putting pressure on Ukraine at the same time. So he says a deal is close. At one point he talked about 1 week, at one point he talked about 2 weeks, but clearly American patience is running out.
President Zelensky says an initial probe suggests a ballistic missile Russia used on Wednesday night was manufactured in North Korea. If confirmed, he said, it would be further proof of the criminal nature of the alliance between Moscow and Pyongyang. President Trump says talks with Iran over a new nuclear agreement are going well. Speaking ahead of technical talks in Oman on Saturday, he said that a very, very good decision could be reached soon.
There are only two options, and the one option is not a good option. It's not a good option at all. And I think we're doing very well on an agreement with Iran. We could have a very, very good decision, and a lot of lives will be saved.
The president, who withdrew from the 2015 agreement, has threatened to bomb Iran if a new deal isn't reached. A medical team treating the former Brazilian president Jair Bolsonaro after intestinal surgery says his health condition has deteriorated. On Wednesday, Mr. Bolsonaro was summoned by a Supreme Court official and given 5 days to present his defense against coup charges. Here's our America's regional editor, Leonardo Rocha.
He's at intensive care in hospital, but he's conscious. He had an operation just over a week ago, a very long operation, 12 hours for this persistent problem that he's had in the guts, in the intestines. And he was recovering, but the fact that he had to be summoned by the Supreme Court, that's what his supporters are saying, that has affected his health, the stress of having to be summoned by the Supreme Court in hospital, that might have had an impact. Others, I mean, who are opposed to former president, say that he's just trying to maximize that for political gains.
BBC News. Witnesses in Mali say dozens of people were shot dead days after being arrested in a market by soldiers and Russian mercenaries. Survivors told the French news agency they were accused of collaborating with Islamist militants and taken to a military camp. The Malian army and Russian mercenaries have been accused of numerous abuses during the fight against the militants. The medical charity MSF says one of its workers has been shot dead by a uniformed attacker in eastern Congo. Another MSF staffer was killed during fighting between M23 rebels and pro-government militia. Both deaths were in the town of Masisi in North Kivu province, where fighting has intensified since M23 launched a new offensive. Israel's military has admitted killing a United Nations worker in Gaza last month, having previously denied responsibility. The Bulgarian national was killed when an Israeli tank shelled a UN compound in Deir al-Bala. The army said it had wrongly identified the building as containing an enemy presence. For over 7 weeks, Israel has prevented any food, fuel or medicine from entering the territory. A portrait of the new coach of the England women's cricket team, Charlotte Edwards, has been unveiled at the Long Room at Lord's. The grand venue in London used to symbolise male dominance of the sport. Jo Wilson reports.
In her portrait, she wears the expression that made many bowlers wilt. Charlotte Edwards set records during her 20-year career, her decade as England's captain, for the number of runs scored and games played, as well as World Cups and Ashes won. But when she started playing for England in the 1990s as a woman, she wasn't even allowed into the Long Room. Now her portrait is right there, immortalising her role in making women's cricket professional.
BBC News.
This is Christina Leffring and Carlos Davalos with your local news, coming to you from the WORT studios on Bedford Street in beautiful downtown Madison. And here are tonight's headlines. An online jobs portal that Governor Tony Evers established for fired federal workers has attracted more than 8,000 views in less than a month, reports the Capital Times. The site lists job openings in state government, as well as links to apply for unemployment benefits and other resources. Several hundred people have signed up for job fairs through the website. An analysis by the New York Times found that the Trump administration has fired at least 58,000 federal workers, with another 76,000 resigning with severance packages. About 18,000 people in Wisconsin were federal employees as of March 2024.
A mostly Republican group of state lawmakers is asking the Trump administration to restore a data breakdown between federal agencies. Their goal? To make access to services for Wisconsin veterans more efficient. The state is working to identify Medicaid recipients who are eligible for VA benefits, but a data sharing dispute between the Centers for Medicaid and Medicaid Services and the Defense and Veterans Affairs Department is hindering their efforts, reports the Capital Times. State Senator Andrea Jack, one of the 12 Republicans who signed onto the request, said that the VA provides a higher quality of medical care, than Medicaid. They also provide vocational and educational services. But this request from state lawmakers comes as the Trump administration makes deep cuts into the VA workforce.
A committee of state lawmakers called on UW system and Department of Administration officials this week to defend their use of DEI programs. One member of the public also spoke up, Greg Jones of the Dane County chapter of the NAACP. He cautioned the legislature's Joint Audit Committee not to yield to politicized attacks and instead give real consideration to the benefits of DEI programs. Republican lawmakers on the committee referred to results of an audit last year that found that no state agencies had tracked expenditures on DEI programs, programs that Governor Tony Evers ordered in 2019. The lawmakers criticized the efforts as racist and of no benefit to the state. Admin Secretary Designee Kathy Blumfield testified that DEI programs have helped the state recruit and retain employees. Democratic legislators on the committee, meanwhile, questioned how much time and money was spent to complete the DEI audit.
state education officials are refusing to obey the Trump administration's demand for proof that DEI programs are being canceled in public schools. But on the local level, some Wisconsin school districts may comply with the order anyway. Fearing the loss of federal funding, school boards in Watertown, Johnson Creek, and Heartland met this week to consider seeking the Department of Education certification, reports Wisconsin Public Radio. The DPI's Deputy Secretary, Tom McCarthy, sent a memo to school district administrators yesterday, writing that they are free to fulfill the order to ensure they don't lose Title I federal aid. Schools in the state get about $261 million in Title I funding, most of which goes to districts with high percentage of low-income students. And in a late development, federal judges in New Hampshire and Maryland issued rulings today that blocked the Trump directive as vague and impinging on teachers' free speech, reports the Associated Press.
A Milwaukee legislator has proposed a bill seeking to encourage and regulate the use of cryptocurrencies, such as Bitcoin, reports the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Democrat Dora Drake's Wisconsin Innovation Network bill would also create a two-year program to educate the public about cryptocurrencies and provide grants to people seeking to establish cryptocurrency-based businesses. Drake, who sits on the Governor's Council for Financial Literacy, says many people have fallen for scams because they lack knowledge about cryptocurrency.
The University of Wisconsin-Madison's Odyssey Project, a long-standing effort to help low-income adults earn college degrees, wants to add housing to its portfolio of services. The Capital Times reports that the increasing cost of housing in Madison is making the expansion into housing a necessity. A similar program in Louisville, Kentucky would serve as a model, says Brian Benford, a success coach at Odyssey House. An administrator in a Louisville affiliate says that program boosts the changes that a single mother will graduate from about 2% to 89%.
A longtime Madison ice cream maker is in hot water, accused of dumping food ingredients and dye into a city storm sewer, reports the Wisconsin State Journal. Shep's Ice Cream has been cited twice for dumping the ingredients, one of which was a purple dye that spilled out of a disposal area. Since 2023, Shep's has been fined 5 times for public health citations, totaling about $5,000. It was also cited last year by the Federal Occupational Safety and Health Administration after workers were exposed to a toxic gas. That fine could exceed $145,000.
Those were the headlines, and now on to the rest of today's top stories.
The Beacon, Dane County's largest daytime homeless shelter, had an unexpected closure all day yesterday. WORT reporter Matvey Mozhaev headed over to speak with those impacted.
The reason for yesterday's closure, plumbing issues.
After speaking with the division administrator, she said that they had an issue with the bathrooms. There were some toilets that had backed up, so there was sewage in the building.
This is Tanya Anderson, communications manager with Dane County Department of Human Services.
So they then have to close, get it cleaned up, get everything ready to invite people back in.
The closure occurred after Beacon already welcomed its customers for the day. Beacon served around 243 individuals per day in 2024.
They didn't give us anything. Said, oh, by the way, you're on your own. Bye.
This is an unhoused person who took a bus from the Beacon to Hawthorne Library.
A lot of people that I was talking to had appointments. Their rides are going to be showing up and there's not going to be anybody there. They got no way to contact them.
Visitors at Hawthorne Library noted that it's not uncommon for unhoused people to come to Hawthorne due to overcrowding at the Beacon. But the library is not prepared for Beacon's closures. It is poorly equipped to support overflow of unhoused people from the Beacon. The library has just one men's stall.
There is no place for the people to go, and if someone is taking time in the stall, there is just no access in the stall in the men's room.
Not everyone from the Beacon had the resources or mobility to find shelter.
And they got the walkers. What about the poor saps with the walkers, the geriatric, the senior citizens?
I headed to East Washington yesterday morning, where I counted over 20 individuals staying at a bus stop near the Beacon. I saw a Madison police officer called to check up on an elderly handicapped person staying under the rain outside of Cargo Coffee on East Washington. They were unable to help, and two care staff arrived for assistance.
For people like me, it's hard to walk over to the library.
And these people pee themselves. Myself, I have a bad bladder. I've got a letter from my doctor that says he has to have access to a restroom at all times. It doesn't work that way. You have to stay in the line sometimes for 15 minutes just to pee.
Unexpected closures at the Beacon significantly impact its customers. So for closures like this, there is a contingency plan.
They have a whole plan, a whole contingency plan in place that if the Beacon does need to close, there are alternatives. They work with the public libraries. If it's a Tuesday or Thursday, they work with Bethel. There's a daytime program there. And they help to get the word out so that people know what's going on, that they should seek an alternative for the day. And then often, too, they'll have staff that go to the places where they're recommending that people go so that there's just some more hands on deck to help out.
It's unclear if the contingency plan was carried out yesterday. The Beacon did not respond to multiple requests for comment from WORT. All of the unhoused people I talked with yesterday sought alternatives by themselves.
Today, we all have to be out in the public eye. We don't have a choice. We have to go sit somewhere. We have to go find a park, find a library, find a bus stop. We have to go somewhere.
Us three, we had to sit out and wait in the lobby just for chairs to open up because it was so packed.
This is referring to Luke House, a community meal program located near the Beacon.
They were very overwhelmed.
I just don't even want to bother with it. I've got this other meeting that I've got to focus on, and I was just like, because I knew that there was going to be, as soon as they said that the Beacon was closed, I was like, you know what, I'm not even going to mess with that breakfast.
We just had everything maintenance the third, last month, they closed the Beacon for maintenance.
For WORT News, I'm Matvey Mozhaev.
The reported number of unhoused students in Wisconsin's public schools hit a record high last year. Also on the rise, the number of children who are unhoused and unaccompanied by an adult. That's according to a new report from Wisconsin Policy Forum, a nonpartisan research organization. WORT reporter David Ahrens has the story.
More than 20,000 students in Wisconsin public schools reported being homeless at some point in the 2023 to 2024 academic year. That's the highest number on record since the state's Department of Public Instruction first made the data available in 2019. Student homelessness went up 9% compared to the previous year, and in the last 2 years, reports have gone up by nearly one-fourth, despite a decrease in student enrollment statewide. Researchers point out that these numbers don't paint the full picture, as the state's data collection relies on self-reporting. Students can be reluctant or embarrassed to confide in their teachers. Don Kramer authored the Wisconsin Policy Forum's report. He tells WORT that it's easier to identify unhoused students in kindergarten and early elementary school.
Younger students have more interactions with the school district, between the family and the school district, and we're assuming that because there's more interactions, there's more opportunities to identify those families in the younger grades. It's a very formal process after the student gets identified. However, before that, the actual flagging of a student, sometimes that's informal. However, as I was talking to district officials, some districts have much more formal system for identifying students in the enrollment period.
Students that do not live with a parent or guardian are called unaccompanied. These students are largely in the 11th and 12th grades, but about 20% of the 9th and 10th graders who are homeless live without a parent or guardian. The reasons for housing insecurity among students is the same as for everyone else. People are struggling to afford housing, an issue that's worse for families who need more than one bedroom.
I'm assuming there's economic issues. You know, we know that there's housing issues across the state. Having affordable housing, it seems like every community there's various housing issues, especially family-friendly housing with multiple bedrooms.
Housing security takes a significant toll on student achievement. The crisis of being homeless is likely to be the focus of the time and attention of parents and students, to the exclusion of schoolwork. Many unhoused students live doubled up with other families, making it more difficult to find a quiet environment to study. And they're less likely to have access to the internet, which is often integral to their education. The 20,000 unhoused students reported last year account for about 3% of all students in the state. But some students are at higher risk than others. English learners and students of color are more likely to experience housing insecurity, both at a rate of about 6%. Disabled students are also at a higher risk, at nearly 4%. Students living in urban areas are also more vulnerable. 7% of all students in Milwaukee were reported homeless last year. The Madison Metropolitan School District says they identified 1,192 unhoused students. That's 4% of the student population. But what kind of responsibility do public schools take on to support their students? Under federal law, there's just one requirement.
And the big one that McKinney-Vento, the federal act that covers their rights, says that if a student loses housing in that district, the still has to provide transportation to get them to their school of origin.
WRT contacted the Madison School District to learn more about the scale of homelessness in our city schools and the services available to them. As of this broadcast, we did not receive responses to those questions. This is David Ahrens for WORT News.
It's now 6:22 p.m. and you're listening to the live local news on WORT.
The United Nations Association, also known as UNA-USA, is an advocacy network that uses community-based programming to advance the United Nations mission. They have more than 200 local chapters across the country. The Dane County chapter is hosting their second annual Women's Summit next Saturday, May 3rd. This year's theme, Women at the Crossroads. Our news producer, Faye Parks, sat down with Mary Rathbun and the chapter's gender equity leader, Devi Kadu Sawada, a new member, to learn how they're approaching global challenges with local action.
Now you're hosting your second annual Women's Summit on Saturday, May 3rd. The theme, Women at the Crossroads, Navigating Global Shifts, Local Realities, and Collective Action. Can you walk us through the programming and the panelists, Mary? What topics do you plan to explore specifically?
Well, we're going to begin with our keynote speaker, Dr. Christine Garlow, who is at UW in gender studies, but also is the UNESCO co-chair on gender well-being and a culture of peace at the university. And Christine is going to discuss her research that shows that women are already stepping up to build community and create change beyond traditional frameworks by working on needs rather than identity. In other words, not on divisions among people, but on the commonality of people. Then we are going to turn, after those general comments, to three specialists who are going to take deep dives, each one, into one of the three major global shifts that we have been looking at. The first one will be Dr. Kaiping Cheng. She's going to speak on the global digital transformation and how it's going to shape the daily lives of men and women here in Dane County. Then we'll turn the floor over to Lauren Parnell Marino, who is a PhD student in development. She's going to talk about the motivations of entrepreneurs in the United States and in Africa and how they run small and medium-sized business. I think that deals with the economic instability that is the whole world is facing. And our last specialist is Dina Eccles, who is a founder of Echo Valley Farms up in Vernon County. She's going to speak on advancing sustainable living and peace in the face of our home, the earth, being in peril. We had our first summit last year. We had about 45 people there, and they were all very complimentary about the content. But the one criticism we had was when they left, they said, okay, we know all this now. We find it fascinating, but what should we do with it? So we have added another component, which is for the attendees, the presenters, and the organizers to co-create a community call to action. We're going to, as a group, identify through breakout groups shared priorities that are based on mutual aid, not identity, and we're going to select one tangible strategic action that offers a clear path forward. And progress on this action will be able to be reviewed at the 2026 summit.
Debbie, as a new member, I'm curious, what part of the summit are you most looking forward to?
Well, I really look forward to this opportunity to have the second summit building on the first summit. And more importantly, it's creating a space for collaboration across generations. My vision for our chapter is really to be a hub of intergenerational dialogue and action where we not only understand the issues, but actually co-create solutions together. And so this particular space is critical in creating the infrastructure to facilitate that for the long haul.
Of course, this is specifically a women's summit. What is the value of having that focus these days? Starting with Mary.
I probably shouldn't say this, but it's pretty self-evident to me why we have to have a women's summit right now. When we look at the misogyny that's inherent in the populist nationalism that is spreading across the globe, that is something that women need to respond to, but it needs to be not only women, it needs to be women and men. We need to build on the foundation we laid last year, because we as a chapter had already realized before the Trump administration began that there were volatile geopolitical competitions like between Israel and Gaza, between Russia and the Ukraine, that were unsettling the global structure that had been in place for a long time. Volatile geopolitical competition, surging populist nationalism, increasing economic instability, destabilizing technology, and a serious climate crisis. And all of those were already threatening the global rules-based order that the UN is at the heart of. Because the UN is has been, for the past 77 years, at the heart of the global rules-based international order grounded in multilateral institutions and institutional law, we were drawn to look at it, and we could see the threats coming. So we began last year to build a community space, because community, it seems to us, is the only way to respond when your institutions, both nationally and internationally, are failing you.
Debbie, do you have anything to add on the value of spotlighting women's voices?
First of all, for me, the reality is that all these challenges aren't distant. They show up in our everyday lives, right here in Madison, right here in our families. We see the impact in housing, in mental health, in education, caregiving, environmental justice, name it. And as Mary has pointed out, this summit is a space for both men and women from all generations and backgrounds to come together. Not to just understand what's happening, but to shape what happens next. But in my experience, it always has to start with the woman. And these global dynamics affect women first and hardest. but they also reveal the urgent need for women's leadership at all levels of society. And so this space is also created to provide women and girls with that confidence boost through community. We need a women's summit now because institutions are under pressure and many are failing to respond adequately, starting with a family institution. Community resilience must rise, and women are often the backbone of that resilience. And intergenerational dialogue can unite experience with innovation. And of course, women's voices are still too often excluded from policy, business, science, and civic life, yet they hold the keys to inclusive, sustainable solutions. So this summit is about creating space to reflect on what's happening, space to connect across lived realities, and space to act collectively, not just in response to crisis, but to shape the future and start thinking more about also how to prevent crises. And above all, when women gather with purpose, that's my experience, the direction of communities and nations can change. When women move forward, the world moves forward.
I've been speaking with Mary Rathbun and Debbie Kadu Sirwada of the Dane County Chapter of the United Nations Association of the United States of America. They're hosting their second annual Women's Summit on Saturday, May 3rd at Christ Presbyterian Church on East Gorham Street. The summit is free and open to all. You can register on their website, unadane.org.
And you're listening to Handcrafted Local News here on WORT. Stay with us. We've got a lot more stories for you coming up in the second half of the show. We'll learn about a state office that answers the public's questions about open records law. We'll look forward to opening day of the regular fishing season, and we'll get the scoop on the flamingos' new uniforms.
But now, we'll take a quick break. Back in a flash.
Do you have an insatiable curiosity about the world? Do you find yourself provoking conversations with your friends and coworkers? Are you a strong listener? Then you should consider applying to become the next host of A Public Affair, WORT's daily hour-long call-in talk program. We're now accepting applications for this volunteer position. The next host will be the voice of Tuesday's show and join a stellar lineup of folks who engage listeners in conversations on social, cultural, and political issues of importance every day of the week. We're looking for someone who is curious and well-informed, comfortable speaking on air, someone who can think on their feet and has at least 5 hours a week to prepare and host the show. And of course, we'll need you to be here every Tuesday from 12 to 1 p.m. Apply by May 2nd. To find out more information or apply, go to wortfm.org/talkhost.
The time is now 6:32, and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. I'm your host, Christina Leffring, here with my co-host, Carlos Davalos. Thank you for joining us. The Office of Open Government, a part of Wisconsin's Department of Justice, serves many functions. One such function is answering inquiries about open records and meeting laws from concerned citizens. This week on Transparency Talk, hosts Bill Leaders and Tom Kamenick discuss the most recent batch of letters released by the DOJ, as well as some of the pitfalls of the current correspondence system. But before we turn it over to Tom and Bill, our standard reminder that this conversation is not intended to be specific legal advice, but rather a discussion of general legal issues. If you have a particular legal issue, please consult an attorney.
Today is every other Thursday, which means it's time for Transparency Talk, the news program that you can see right through. I'm Bill Leaders, and I'm the president of the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council, a statewide group that promotes open government. And I'm here with Tom Kamenick, the founder and president of the Wisconsin Transparency Project, a law firm devoted to open government. Hello, Tom.
Hello, Bill.
Today, we're going to talk about one particular function of the Office of Open Government, which is part of Wisconsin's Department of Justice. The Office for Open Government, or OOG, as we sometimes call it, writes letters on a regular basis responding to people's questions and concerns about the state's open meetings and its open records law. A new batch of these was just released last week. They're released on a quarterly basis. And we pore over them and look at them. We see trends and we see the way that various queries are responded to.
Under state statutes, anybody has the right to contact the DOJ and ask questions about the records or meetings laws and get a written response back. So listeners, if you see some suspicious behavior, and if you're not sure if it violates the law or not, you can write to DOJ and they'll address your questions or concerns.
Eventually they will, but one big problem is that they aren't very prompt in responding, are they?
No. Even though people's concerns are often time sensitive, DOJ varies wildly in how long they take to respond. Under both Democratic and Republican attorneys general, the response times to these letters have been way too long. That was true under Republican Attorney General Schimmel and before him Van Hollen. Remains true under Democratic Attorney General Joshua Call. It frequently takes a year or even longer to get a written response, and that's hardly helpful for people. Now, to be fair, over the past 6 or 9 months or so, they have been getting a little better. They're addressing the backlog. Some people are starting to get responses in a matter of weeks rather than months.
So the last batch had 22 letters that were written in response. 15 of those were sent between 11 and 14 months after the request was made for them to respond. Tom, what type of advice comes in these letters?
The advice is pretty sound. These OOG attorneys and staff, they know a ton about the records and meetings laws. They deal with them all the time. That said, the advice that you get is usually a lot of boilerplate language. It tends to typically be taken from or be very similar to what DOJ is publishing in their compliance guides for the records and the meetings law. You'll usually get about as much guidance from those guides as you will from these letters.
Yeah, and the Department of Justice actually just published an update of its open meetings compliance guide. And we're told that an update of its open records compliance guide should be released soon. So people write to the DOJ. They most often want to know whether a government agency is in compliance with the law or whether they're violating the law. Will OOG answer that question, Tom?
Not often enough. It's pretty rare that they do. This might be the most frustrating thing about these letters. You know, going back in history a little bit, back when these started, or especially like in the 80s and 90s after the modern records law was enacted, DOJ letters would frequently come down clearly on one side or the other. Yes, the law was broken. No, it's not. They would often qualify those conclusions a little. You know, they might say, based on what you've told us, we can tell you that this is or isn't true, but there might be facts that change that conclusion. If it's actually happened a little bit differently like that, or if we learned a little more about it, we might reach a different conclusion. But they give you an answer pretty often that was attached to the instance that you described, the facts that you described. Today, it's quite different. Very rare for one of these letters to offer an opinion, to say, yes, that violates the law, or no, it doesn't. And DOJ will be extra noncommittal if you ask anything about the actions of state officials or state agencies, like, anybody at the governor's office, the legislature, any of the departments that are found in the state government, like the Department of Natural Resources. You write a letter about that and DOJ will almost always say, well, we might be called on to represent them in any action, so we can't offer you any advice.
Yeah, that can be very frustrating. The Department of Justice is essentially saying they won't enforce the law if it's being broken by state-level actors. Or they say that they won't provide an answer or give a clear determination of whether the law is being broken because they don't have sufficient facts. One way or another, they find a way to not directly answer the question that's most on people's minds. So one thing they do sometimes, which is a good thing, is they contact the agency that the letter is written about. They make the records custodian or the government agency that has allegedly violated the means law aware of the concern that has been raised. At least that spreads some indication that the state is paying attention to these issues and trying to advise people as the right way to go.
Yeah, I like seeing that. Oftentimes in these letters, like you say, the DOJ will write, we brought this attention to your local fire department, made them aware of your concerns. So even if DOJ is not bringing the hammer down and bringing enforcement actions when people are violating the law, at least you're getting this, hey, we're aware of this, we're watching you, kind of a message from DOJ. And, you know, that can go a long way in ensuring compliance.
So, Tom, do you see anything of interest in the batch of letters that was released last week? A particular interest, I should say.
Yeah, there's a few things in there. There was a couple letters, a little bit ironic, that highlight why DOJ's slow response time is such a problem. So two of these letters, people are complaining about delays from their local governments in providing records. They write the letter to DOJ, and a year later, DOJ writes back and tells them what you or I or anybody with a passing understanding of the records law could have told them. The law doesn't have a strict deadline. They have to produce records as soon as practicable and without delay. So you can either file a lawsuit or threaten them with one or maybe get an attorney to get the records released.
Anything else?
There was one example of a clear answer this time that was good. Somebody complained about the town of Caledonia posting a meeting agenda that had the incorrect time on it. And DOJ rightly pointed out, you can't do that. You have to have the correct time on your notice or it's not proper notice.
Any other observations from this last batch of letters?
I had to laugh at one. Somebody was complaining that their local government agency was charging $1 per page in reproduction costs. And the DOJ, even though their own guidance, they say their cost is about 1.5 cents. DOJ was not willing to say that $1 per page was an excessive reproduction fee. And I thought that was a little ridiculous.
So that's about all the time that we have for today. I'm Bill Leaders here with Tom Kamenick. Thanks to Crow Cremines for producing. We'll be back in 2 weeks for another installment of Transparency Talk, the news program that you can see right through.
It's always a pleasure, Bill. And remember, everybody, if you don't ask, you won't know.
Opening day of the regular fishing season is just around the corner, and Nate Wiggy Hout and Pat Hasberg take a look at what's happening around town in this week's fishy business.
Alrighty, I'm on the line now with Pat Hasberg over at the DNS Bait Shop here in Madison. Pat, we're now just a couple of weeks away from opening day of, you know, the full fishing season. But we'll get to that in just a little bit. But just taking a look out around town, well, what has the fishing been like on the lakes around town here?
The fishing has been great. We have, you know, of course, there's some restrictions on fishing. There, like you mentioned, game fish season is closed, but you can still fish for bass. All bass have to be immediately released, but there are lots of folks getting some good action in shallow water. So anywhere around the chain, if you can find some shallow water, you've got a decent chance at getting bass. And of course, panfish is open, and you can keep those fish. A lot of folks are doing well in the same shallow areas. Basically, anywhere shallow around town is where all of your fish are basically going to be right now. Some of the hot spots for panfish lately have been Cherokee Marsh here on the north side. They've been getting some at the 113 Bridge area. And Monona Bay, of course, remains just probably the panfish capital of southern Wisconsin. It's just got a lot of bluegills in there during the day and the crappies during the night or evening, and then into after dark has been really good. So, yeah, I mean, that basically covers it for the chain. All your lakes, just fish shallow, and you're going to likely be finding some fish.
And now, as we're sticking with the Madison lakes here, I want to touch on something that's maybe not fishing related per se, but certainly fish related, and that is over at Wingra, the Wingra Dam. The muskies are jumping up the dam. Is that correct, Pat?
That's right. Those fish move up out of Lake Monona, and they move into Lake Wingra to spawn. It happens every year. They get backed up there at the Wingra Dam, right kind of by the zoo and the hospitals there. And it's just a really cool time to go down and check out some very impressive fish. You could go down there and see muskies over 50 inches. And, they're trying to get up the dam, so they're trying to jump there, and you can kind of cheer them on. It's a great thing to do with kids. I know I used to bring my kids down there, and it's just a great time, really a special time of year. Of course, I do want to remind folks that the area below that dam is closed down to Arboretum Drive as a fish refuge to protect those fish that are down there. But it's really, really cool. If somebody wants to go down there and check it out, it's great.
Like we said, that's not fishing-related news necessarily, but it is fish news, and it is great to go and check it out. I always like to go and, you know, spend a little bit of time just watching them, because, like you said, they're huge fish, and that's just fun to watch. Well, now I want to move over to some of the rivers around the area, because river fishing now, that is open at the moment. So let's start off with the Wisconsin River. What are you hearing coming out of there right now?
Well, the walleye spawn is over, so... I think the last time we talked, we were talking about walleyes backed up at all the dams, and we were kind of waiting for the females to show up. That has happened, but not all is lost there, because now we're looking at the good post-spawn bite. So after those fish have been, you know, kind of doing their thing and maybe not focusing on eating, now they are hungry and they are looking for food. So you can still get them up at the dams or any deep hole kind of below dams as they sort of start to filter back down into their summer hidey holes there. But any dam, so the Sauk Dam at Prairie du Sac, Wisconsin Dells, Castle Rock, Peenwell, all those spots are going to be holding fish. And same thing down on the Rock River. So you'd be looking at the Indian Ford Dam, where they're also getting some white bass. Same thing at the Jefferson Dam. But the Port Atkinson area, too, there's a lot of nice deep corners in there so that the fish are starting to filter back down into. So it's a great time to get out and chase walleyes for sure.
The Rock River is always a great place to go and do a little bit of fishing if you don't want to head west. If you want to head east instead, it's great to check out. Well, now I want to move over to, like I said, we have the full fishing season opening up in a little bit here, and that includes trout fishing is open on May 3rd. That's the first Saturday of the month. So I want to talk about, or the first Saturday of May. So I want to talk a little bit about the trout bite just so that we can start getting ready. What have you been hearing around the area?
The trout have been in a great mood. Now that we're kind of past the huge fluctuations in temperature where it's going to, you know, cool streams down and then you got to wait for them to warm up, these fish are ready to roll. They're, you know, just enjoying the warmer temperatures. If you're using spinning gear, I would recommend, well, you can't use live bait until May 3rd. You can go out and catch trout. You have to immediately release them until May 3rd. But so this time of year, you'd be looking at small spinners, jerk baits like a Rapala Husky Jerk is a great option, or even just like a small crappie tube jig drifted through some deeper runs is a great way to catch trout. On the fly side of things, April and May are prime time for fly fishing. So you're looking at getting, there's a lot of insects that are hatching right now. Right now there's blue-winged olives that are coming off. So if you got some of those in your box, you're in good shape. But the caddis hatch is right around the corner. I've heard a few murmurs of caddis hatching, but this next week, with these warmer temps coming up, it's going to be game on for those fish. So it's a very exciting time and a great time to be out doing any trout fishing.
And now, like I mentioned before, May 3rd, it's the first Saturday in May. That is when the full regular fishing season opens. So, Pat, just to sort of wrap things up here a little bit, what do people need to know about about opening day?
Well, that's when you can basically keep all species of fish. So whereas right now we talk about bass and we talked about trout needing to be immediately released, and you can't fish for walleye or pike or muskies, all that changes on May 3rd. So folks can get out and keep fish if they choose. Of course, you do need a valid fishing license, which expired on March 31st for everybody. So make sure you're up on that and, you know, make sure you're stocked up ahead of time so you don't have to deal with the rush, the madness that goes on at day chaps on opening day for sure.
Definitely. It is a great day to get out there. It will probably be a little bit busy, so everyone be kind to each other and, you know, stay safe out there. But, yeah, that is it's just around the corner. It's almost here. Summer fishing. It doesn't really feel like summer quite yet out there, but it's regular season is almost here. Well, Pat, that'll just about do it here for today. Remember, you can hear an updated fishing report anytime that you want just by calling one easy number. That's 608-BIG-FISH. Pat, thank you again for talking with me this week, and good luck out there.
Thanks, Nate. You too. Enjoy opening day. Good luck.
It's now 6:49 p.m. and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. Forward Madison hosted their USL League One home opener this past Saturday, squaring off against league newcomers Texoma FC. But before that, club captain Mitch Osmond and head coach Matt Glazer spoke with fans at a reveal event for their new home uniform about the new shirt, the league opener, and the effect fans have on the game.
Hello again and welcome to everyone listening to WORT online and at 89.9 FM on your radio dial. This is another edition of Forward Focus, a segment devoted to any and all things Forward Madison FC, Wisconsin's only fully professional soccer team. I'm one of your hosts, Grant Peters, assistant editor for cultural and Forward Madison theme magazine New Dogma Zine. As always, the editor of NDZ and the producer of Forward Focus is Andrew Schmidt. When we last joined you, Forward Madison were preparing to hit the road to take on former Flamingo Christian Cheney and the Charlotte Independents. Both teams would struggle to get much going offensively until the 83rd minute when Charlotte's Luis Alvarez fired one home to give them a 1-0 lead. Forward Madison would counter, however, as in the 88th minute, following a free kick play straight off the training ground, Nazim Bartman would head it home to tie the score. The goal was Bartman's third in three games and would secure Madison a point as the match ended at a draw in one apiece. Forward Madison then returned to the friendly confines of Bree Stevens Field on last Saturday when they took on newcomers Texoma FC in the USL 1 home opener. In front of a home crowd hungry for some goals, Forward Madison would again struggle offensively as they just couldn't get anything going against a squad who had given up 12 goals in their previous four matches. Forward Madison would even find themselves down against Texoma following Texoma's goal in the 73rd minute. However, Derek Gebhard would once again play the hero for Madison as his tap-in in the 5th minute of extra time would tie the match and rescue another point for the Mingos with a 1-1 draw. For this week's segment, Forward Madison captain Mitch Osmond and head coach Matt Glazer joined last Friday's NDZ Live podcast to discuss the club's newest home kit release and get their thoughts on the USL 1 home opener at Breeze. Andrew, take it away.
Mitch Osmond, welcome to the show.
What is going on, everybody? You're right. I think I should start getting paid for this, huh?
Yeah, probably. We'll work that into your contract next year, right?
Yeah.
Mitch, let's talk about this new kit. You've worn more than a few Forward Madison kits at this point. How does this one stack up?
I think it's up there. I think it's a bit of a throwback to the first year.
Yeah, absolutely.
With a modern twist to it. And what I like is that it's quite different to the last one we had. It's a big change. It's fresh. I think the fans are going to like it on the boys out there tomorrow.
What's your favorite part about it so far?
I like the color, I'm going to be honest.
I knew it.
I like the color, yeah.
Yeah, it's good. So do players actually care about the kit design, or is it just about how it fits?
They care a lot.
So
your next guests care a lot.
Yeah, okay. So, I'm looking at you three right now.
Handsome devils.
Yeah.
Look at them.
Look at them handsome devils right there. Explain a little bit more about what makes it, why do players care so much about that?
You know, I think it's just you want to look good when you're on the pitch, and
you look good, you play good, right?
There you go. That's exactly.
Right. That's right.
You want something clean. You want something that fits the club and looks good on field. Look good, feel good, play good, you know?
So, Mitch, got to ask, what's your mindset heading into a home opener like this? New team, big night, league home opener at Breeze.
Win.
Mm.
Yeah. What else do you want? Yeah. Everyone showing up? You want to see
Simple,
us win.
So straight up.
Winning the new kits.
Yeah, love it.
You know?
Mm.
Goodbye, jersey.
I mean, yeah.
So that's in my contract, commission on jersey sales.
You heard it here, folks. Mitch Osmond is a
discount
company
code
man.
Mitch Osmond.
Company man.
So, I mean, what do you want the crowd to feel when this team walks out tomorrow?
a continuation of last year, I think. I think we were really dominant at home last year. I want to say more than any previous season. So we want to continue on that, build on it, even add to what we did last year at home and keep this place as a fortress. We want this to be a place where people don't like coming, and we have our part in that on the pitch. And what I thought last year was the environment from the fans was as true of a 12th man as we could get. I mean, I don't think there were many teams that enjoyed their time coming here, which is, it's a massive thing for us.
Welcome back to the show, multiple time guests. You know him, you love him. Tomorrow there's a lookalike contest for him.
Despite him not coaching.
Matt Glazer, everybody.
So shifting gears just a little bit, Matt. I mean, being here a few years for Madison, you know how much this crowd, you know, means to the club. You know, I guess for you, what role do they play for you coming into games like tomorrow, and I guess even for the remainder of the year? You know, yeah. What are you looking forward from them?
No, it's funny. I mean, you and I were just talking outside. I mean, I think it's rare even that we're in a situation like this in our league. Like, this isn't something that every team has, and so. I feel extremely fortunate. I know the players do. To even be, like, for instance, in this situation where we're sitting around talking about the game tomorrow with a group of fans that are here, that are solely invested in what we're doing, a group of guys who care deeply about the team, a group of fans that care deeply about the team. We're unique in that situation. I can promise you. I've been in the professional game for a long time, and I think that. I think what we do here is unique, you know, and I think we shouldn't take it for granted. So, I mean, from my perspective, guys, I'm thrilled. I'm thrilled to be here at Fort Madison. I'm thrilled for the product that we have. I'm thrilled for the fan base. I think that we're unique. I think that what you guys as fans bring is unique. You know, you guys as fans are the lifeblood of this thing. And really, at the end of the day, like when the crowd's jumping, the guys are excited. I mean, I can tell you in training all week, Eric, like, you know how it is, man. Like, the guys are smiling. There's a little bit of a bounce in the step. It's a little bit different than if we're going on the road to California or somewhere, you know. It's guys are excited.
Fort Madison FC will be back in action this Saturday as they'll kick off group play in the 2025 Jägermeister Cup with a matchup at home against USL Championship outfit Indy 11. Kickoff will be at 6 p.m. and tickets are now available. Following that, Fort Madison will welcome in DeBree Stevens' USL 1 rivals Union Omaha on May 3rd. Kickoff will be at 5 p.m. and tickets are now available as well. For both matches, live coverage will be available on ESPN+. And that'll do it for this week. As always, we hope that you'll join us throughout this season as Andrew and I continue to keep you up to date on all the news, updates, and stories coming out of Bree Stevens Field as Fort Madison continues their quest for USL 1 glory in the 2025 season. For WORT, this has been Forward Focus.
And that does it for our show. Thanks for listening to WORT's live local news at 6. Russ Mackey was your headline writer. Your reporters were David Ahrens and Matvey Mojaev. Special thanks for feature contributors Bill Leaders, Tom Kamenik, Crowena Kremiens, Nate Wiggehout, and Pat Hasberg, and the Forward Focus crew. Dave Lorenzen engineered this show, Faye Parks produced this newscast, and Shelley Pittman is the news director at WORT. I'm your host, Christina Leffring.
And I'm your host, Carlos Dávalos. Stay up to date with the WORT local news podcast. Subscribe on iTunes Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcast. Up next is a Perpetual Motion Machine. Good night.
Attention WORT volunteers and donors. WORT is holding an election for 2 open participating member seats and 1 open listener sponsor seat to serve 3-year terms on the board of directors of Back Porch Radio Broadcasting, Inc., with terms beginning at the annual meeting in June and concluding at the annual meeting in June 2028. financial acumen, computer literacy, and a willingness to work within a dynamic group to help shape this great station are all desirable qualifications. People of underrepresented groups are strongly encouraged to apply. Some committee hours are required outside of board meetings. Applications must be received by 5 p.m. on Thursday, May 15th to ensure consideration. Voting begins Thursday, May 29th and continues until the annual meeting on Sunday, June 29th. More information and board applications are available at wardfm.org or on paper in the station lobby. Help us keep WORT a vibrant and important part of our community. Apply today.
You're listening to WORT 89.9 FM Madison.
Make Music Madison is back on June 21st for the 13th annual day of free outdoor live music across the city. Here's how you can get involved. Online registration for musicians to participate and venues to schedule events is open through June 1st at makemusicmadison.org. All genres and styles of music are welcome, and there are no age limits or skill levels required. The Make Music Madison website is used to match artists who need a stage with venues who seek performers. At noon on June 20th, matchmaking ends and all shows must be confirmed in the system. Again, advance registration for venues and musicians at makemusicmadison.org closes at 11:59 p.m. on Sunday, June 1st. And mark your calendars for Make Music Day on Saturday, June 21st. Bringing you a variety of music every day of the year, this is WORT Madison.
Good evening and welcome to the Perpetual Notion Machine, the science news program on WORT 89.9 FM Madison. It's Earth Week. Today on the show, we're revisiting a conversation from earlier this week about the climate emergency. Tetra Pak-Man